I'm telling you about. He's so cute. Once I gave him this raspberry and he rolled it around in his little hands, and it was almost like he was trying to do close-up magic.
Maybe he was trying to pull rabies out of your ear.
Randall would never do that. He's not that type of raccoon. He's totally cool.
You are listening to Two Magicians, One Mic.
Welcome to Two Magicians, One Mic. My name's Nick Paul. How are you, Simon Cornell?
I'm well. I'm in an intense place.
Intense?
It's not a bad thing.
You know what's intense? Camping. Rimshot.
What?
Camping.
That's actually really funny.
It's a stupid joke.
What's that? It's like there's even worse joke about the guy who goes into the doctor's office and says, like, I'm messed up. I think I'm a teepee and a wigwam. And the doctor goes, calm down. You're too tense.
Yep.
Yeah, that is like that's a bad joke. I don't even think that's good bad. That's just bad.
Yep.
So now that we've got the real stuff out of the way, let's get to the frivolous nothingness.
So you've been carrying around a stack of card 15.
I'm carrying this stack of cardstock. It's about the size of 3 cinder blocks. It's enormous, and I brought it back from Santa Monica. On the metro because reasons.
So we're in North Hollywood, Santa Monica.
It's a long way away.
It's very far away.
It's about an hour and a bit on 2 metro lines for reasons. And it's for a magic trick. It's something I'm working on. I need long. This is actually a really good insight into the magic research and development creative process. So I've got this idea for a trick. It's a great trick. It's going to be really funny and amazing and blah, blah, blah. We'll play great on stage, help me fill those shows with good stuff. Particularly on ships, we need 90 freaking minutes of material. So you're looking for good pack, small plays, medium stage material. And the trick needs a gaffed mailer envelope, you know, like a peel and seal, stiff cardboard mailer thing. And that's cool. You can get existing mailers and modify them to do the thing. But for various reasons, having now done the trick a few dozen times, which is enough to begin to get the idea of really what the trick is, the problem is conventional mailer envelopes are either too big or too small or too stiff. They all work, but they're not great. The trick would be better if I could have one made of slightly thinner cardstock, but meet halfway between letter and half letter size.
This is fascinating.
There's a lot of little variables. Plus, it has to be one that you can't easily unstick. It has to be very strong adhesive. Again, when you actually do a trick, when you actually do it out there in the real world dozens to hundreds of times, you discover these tiny details about it that, you know, you can't know when just theory crafting on your couch or in front of the TV or whatever. And so I've been shopping around for the last 6 months of doing this trick for better mailer envelopes, trying to find the perfect mailer envelope that'll really make this trick pop in all the ways it needs to. And long story short, during this, I was like modifying existing mailer envelopes more and more extensively to make them kind of fit the best thing. And I finally realized, you know what? It's actually at this point going to be barely more work and a lot better if I just make the mailer envelopes from scratch myself. But then finding the cardstock that mailer envelopes are made of, you know, white coated on the outside and that kind of unfinished interior, you know, so that they look normal, was surprisingly tricky. And I finally, through a friend who works at a printing company, found a paper supplier in Santa Monica that has the stock I needed, but they only sell it, as you can see, Nick, by the stack of 1,000 sheets. I don't even know what that is. It's probably more like 400.
Yeah, 11 by 17 there.
I think it's something like 400 sheets was their minimum quantity. It was $40, which is actually quite a bargain. That's fine. But that was the minimum quantity. So I went down to Santa Monica and carried this stack back.
And we bring this up because sometimes magic is just arts and crafts. Very expensive arts and crafts. I'm in the same boat, been doing this. I've been remaking the same stupid, you know, force card thingy. And I've probably spent at least $50 to $100 on something I could just easily do a glide force on.
Yeah.
But alas,
hey, no talking methodology. Normal people listen to this too.
Could
preserve the mystery.
Could make people choose a card I wanted to.
I mean, there are ways. People know about that.
Yeah,
so I'm hopeful that this will fix it. And yeah, it's not just arts and crafts. There's obviously way more to it than that. But yeah, a significant arts and crafts component.
It's
that you never know about.
Yeah, and it's mentally draining in certain ways because you don't know if like what you're working on is actually going to be be anything because you spend a lot of time just kind of reworking stuff to get to the point of, is this actual? Is this actually usable
on stage? Yeah, even getting to the point where it's you can really know if it's got potential can be a huge journey. And this will be familiar to anyone in any sort of intricate creative field. I mean, similar in software development when you're trying to make code that works. We've got our friend Darcy, amazing kind of set designer and model maker who makes these Up houses, like the house from Up, but tiny ones out of craft. She went through this hilarious saga trying to get good little beads to be the balloons. And it was this whole incredibly complex process to get the ones that were the right size, but then the right consistency, and then what glue will work on them. And a lot of people hear these things and think, well, that's ridiculous. But no, it's not. This is what it takes to actually create stuff, to really get things to be great.
Yeah, and I noticed that a lot in L.A., people who pay attention to the details in ways, and it's taught me to do it in ways that I never have before.
Yeah.
Because there's a tension in the details.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Forgive me if I'm cutting in and out. My mic is this whole fancy setup here, and the mic I'm using is cutting out. So.
Well,
so,
and it's interesting also because I was thinking about this a lot recently when thinking about what details to pay attention to. For example, with this podcast, I'm watching it with hilarity as you set up this insane amount of equipment we've got in this recording booth. And I'm thinking, is this really necessary? I can't hear the difference. But then there are audiophiles out there who absolutely can hear the difference, even though I can't, who will, like, if I see a website, and that website, if I can see it's been badly coded, like it's got JavaScript errors that are subtly visible that no normal human would notice, if I notice that, I lose respect for the person. Like, sure. My evaluation of them goes down. They aren't aware of that, but it's happening.
Yeah.
And the same thing happens with your audio quality, with your dress, with your clothes, with your grooming, with how you smell, like all kinds of things. Just because you don't think that detail's important,
yeah,
guaranteed there are at least 2 or 3 out of 100 people, minimum, often way more, in your audience who do think those details matter and will notice them and will judge you on them.
It's interesting how magic has, I think, half the people in magic understand that, and that's the reason they went into it, because they want to be so specific about these things. And then there's the other half of, hey, it's good enough.
Yeah. I still remember one of the dumbest things I ever heard a magician say. Literally the stupidest thing I think I ever heard a magician say. It was Glenn Falkenstein, who I think is now passed on. So now I can talk shit about him, I guess. Is that how that works? I don't know.
Sure. Sorry, Glenn.
Glenn, you're great. Love you. But it was on one of his DVDs, Falkenstein and Willard, like magic teaching DVD. A friend had a copy and we were watching it. And they were doing this sort of, it was some kind of pseudo-psychic mentalism thing where you get blindfolded. You know, you put coins over your eyes, then tape your eyes shut with the coins and then blindfold over that. And then he had this metal visor thing that was just a sort of, like wraparound glasses made of metal. And he said in the show, they had a performance clip in the explanations, that he said, oh, this is, you know, and these are, this is something, things blind people wear so that they don't get like flashes of light in their peripheral vision. Because you could, you know, if you're part, you know, almost no one's fully blind, if you're partially blind. And I immediately went, what? That does? And then in the explanation, he said, and I'm quoting as close as I can, oh, yeah, and I explained this to justify what this is, because you need to justify what things are. Right? Yes, good. Yep, that's a correct concept in magic. You need to justify it. And, you know, blind people wear it so they don't get flashes of light. And that makes sense to me, so that's a good explanation. I went, the idea that because it makes sense to you, that makes it okay? Ah, my God. Just the profound, utter disconnect between him and nearly everyone in his audience at that point. It's like my pet peeve is when a lot of magicians, when talking about doing, you know, coin vanishes or whatever, you'll often hear people mentioning something, if I do this, the molecules of the coin get softer or vanish or disassociate or whatever.
Yeah.
Coins don't contain molecules. They contain atoms in a metallic lattice. Now, almost no one knows that, right? I'm the only person, you know, there's not many people going to realize that, but there are 2 or 3 people out of 100 in your audience who are physicists or chemists or dipshits like me who are interested in this stuff, who will think, oh, you're an idiot when you say things like that. Every detail matters to someone.
I've learned that doing, like, adding number tricks into the show where, exactly like you said, 90% of the audience is like, oh, wow, that's great. And then I've had people come up to me and go, I don't know how you did it, but there was a zero at the end of that number,
exactly.
And you
so
didn't
it had to
type
be
in any
of
zero.
10 or, or 5 or 2 and 10, or that was a prime
it
number.
It wasn't even something I would consider, but it's good to it's you want to play to the smartest person in the room. Yeah. You don't want to play to the point where it makes everybody else feel dumb, but you do want to make sure you can
because
cover your bases.
Sometimes that smartest two or three people in the room are the ones who would book you, but now aren't going to because of whatever reason. They go, oh, no, this person sucks.
Yeah. This kind of segues into something I want to talk about. I've been writing a few – I have about like three or four new ideas that are just like randomly popping into my head, and I'm trying to work right now. And it's funny. This is after like a six-month drought of nothing, nothing coming in my brain at all. And I was curious of what
so
your –
so to speak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. jokes. moving on. I'm curious what your thought process is of writing new stuff and how you make it work. And because that's where I'm trying to figure it out right now. Because I always like start off with a great idea. I'm like, this is going to be awesome. This is going to kill. And then I get like a page or two into writing it. And I'm like, I can't go any further with this. I don't know what to do.
Yeah. I mean, the creative process is such a such a personal thing. Everyone approaches it differently, and I don't think there's a right or wrong way. One of the big things, again, it's the same with an engineering or design background, going top down or bottom up, which in magic is top down is you have the idea for the routine and then you work down towards the methods. You find a way to make this happen. And then there's bottom up, which is you find an amazing method. You find a cool way to create, you know, to make a square thing look circular or whatever. Someone figures out a great method or you see a trick. And then go bottom up. You work up to finding a good actual total presentation that fits into as a way to make that entertaining. And sometimes it's both. Like the way, I mean, creatively, I keep a note file on my phone synced to Dropbox in a series of marked up text files. Because I like I don't really care about pencil and paper. I like the fact that it's backed up and searchable more than the handwriting experience. And when I get ideas randomly, it's not like I've never been able to create ideas on demand. They either just hit me or they don't randomly. And I'll go, holy crap, that's a great idea. Write it down. I know I'll forget it otherwise. And I end up usually with half ideas. And it was like, here's a great idea for a method for something, but I have no idea how to kind of turn this into an engaging presentational performance piece. Or I have a great idea for the latter, but there's no method for it. And then every now and then, 1 in 10, 20, 50 times, finally two halves will match up and I'll go, oh, this is something that could have legs. And then I work on it and spend the money and buy the cardstock and all that crap. And then maybe 1 in 10 times it actually ends up being good.
This cardstock right here?
This. Hang on. Let's drop it so we hear the
thud. Let's hear it. Wow, that's heavy.
Yep. It's big. Probably weighs about 20 pounds, I think. Maybe more. I don't even know. How much is a pound? 1 point, half a kilo.
What are you?
I'm still struggling with imperial measurements.
Well, you know, we're so arrogant here in America that we're the only one that uses that system because it's correct.
I think there's actually three other tiny countries that do it too.
That's true. I did see the map. My friend sent it to me recently. This one, this tiny country, and this other country that nobody has ever heard of.
Yeah, but to be fair, that's the same as similar to countries that drive on the left hand side.
It's true,
including my home country.
Mm-hmm. You guys, what is it when we were in Hong Kong?
Oh, yeah.
London.
And basically the former British Empire. Really. Yeah. Literally, that's actually pretty much it at this point.
Yeah. This segues into what I also want to talk about, ships. So I was on, I don't know where I was, some island in the Caribbean, Bonaire or something like that. Mm. And it was weird how quickly my reference to the people driving on the opposite side of the road came back to me after being 3 months in China. It was just like, oh, yep, car's going that way now. And it was weird. I didn't even have to think about it. Yeah. It was like muscle memory. And the first time I went to London, I kept almost getting hit by cars.
Oh, yeah. And it's amazing, is it? Because you think, oh, I'll just look both ways every time. And you think you could do that. You think that'd be easy. It's really not. You don't realize how instinctive some of these behaviors become, that in a moment of forgetfulness, you just reflexively look the other way. Mm-hmm. And that's happened to me. I'm a very analytically rationally minded person, still slave to instincts.
Mm-hmm. Gonna maybe get hit by a bus.
Yeah.
You get it. That's creating stuff, working on things.
And also for me, I've never managed to write a script successfully for magic, as in By which I mean I've written down scripts, but they were very much transcriptions of what I was already saying and then editing from there. For me, it's always been like sketching a line. I go up, and I have a partially improv background anyway, which makes it easier. I go up with, you know, with kind of an idea of what this routine is going to be in my head, and I work to that structure, but always end up flexing or ad-libbing or going off the rails when I realize, what's that, whose quote was it? No plan survives its first contact with the enemy in warfare. It was some American general, I think. And he's dead right. The plans don't survive their first contact with reality, including your plan of what you are going to say in your trick, if you're willing to be present and really look to the audience. You realize, this isn't working the way I thought. Unless you're just a person who's brilliant and can write that way, which some people are, but that is not me.
I worked with Rob Zabrecki last year, and if you haven't listened to the interview I did with him on this podcast, do it, because it's awesome. But we were just backstage, and he had his whole show scripted out like a play. Yeah. And for what he does, that's awesome, and it works well. And I've tried, and I kind of have parts of the show scripted out that way, but it's tough, like you said, when you come from an improvised background where I'm the same way, I'm going to react to something that happens in the audience because that's just how I'm wired. And I love moments that are completely scripted out, and I can, you know, do blindfolded upside down, but I can never make it feel as authentic, you know, as opposed to commenting on something that's happening in real time.
Well, it's still one of my absolute favorite quotes ever is that there are many paths up to the top of the mountain. There are many ways to reach the mountaintop. Mm-hmm. And one of those is the Zabrecki style, flawlessly scripted brilliance. And it really is. He's fantastic. But then genuine, pure improv shows are among my favorite things ever to watch. Because there is that realness and that genuine spontaneity that can't be faked.
Yeah.
And I prefer the latter over the former, if I had to pick one. And I'm always striving for ways to lean more into that, to find more ways to make the routines genuinely spontaneous depending on the way the audience reacts with it.
And spontaneous is the word, it's genuinely spontaneous because I've
not
seen
just fake
shows,
spontaneous.
I've seen shows where I've gone up to the guys after, I'm like, oh, was that, did that actually happen? Or did you just set that up? It's like, oh no, that happened 5 years ago. We do this every show.
Yeah.
And it's such a punch in the nuts because you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, you know what it is? I still remember way back, I think we might have talked about this previously. As a non-magician, as a teenager, maybe 15 or 16, had never gotten to magic at all. I was a total layman. Went to see David Copperfield in Melbourne. He toured there back in the 90s. And it was amazing and very impressive.
Was it the Magic for the 90s show?
It was pretty 90s.
That was a real title of one of them.
You know what? And Rudy Kobe was touring at the same time.
Nice.
That was very 90s. So it was very 90s. What was the 90s?
All around,
so it made sense. It was very modern and relevant. And I, you know, did the grandfather's aces routine, the four ace trick, and it was amazing.
Great.
It was like so incredible and wow. And years later, I mean, only maybe 2 or 3 years later, because I got into magic when I was 18 at university, I spoke to someone who, you know, was a magic industry veteran who made a joke in passing that, you know, that story wasn't true. That wasn't really his grandfather's ace trick. And I remember I felt betrayed. I felt betrayed as a human being that someone had lied to me. It's not like it's a big deal, but no, that's not.
I was the same way when I found out he was Jewish about the snow routine.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he talks about it was being Christmas Eve and seeing snow. And
again, some people care, some people don't. But for me, I always have wanted to live my life in a way that if someone knew the true backstory behind everything I was doing, they would still respect me as a person.
Yeah, and
I won't compromise on that.
And I'm still a massive Copperfield fan.
He's the reason. I mean, the man's a living legend.
This. Yeah, but I felt that same sense of just hopelessness almost where I'm like, oh, that wasn't
just,
real.
I invested emotionally into something that was actually bullshit.
You feel fooled in a different way.
Yeah, in a bad way, in a betrayed way. And again, most people don't care about it. It's still an intelligent business practice from his point of view. I mean, because we're not the target audience.
And I love
people
the idea
depth
of
and sincerity.
I love the idea of storytelling, and I love the idea of being able to have a emotional connection into what you're doing. But I think too many people, and I myself included, at one time or another, you know, use it falsely, and it's just such a slap in the face to the audience. Yeah. I think.
And I mean, and I've been guilty of that in the past. Like I've unintentionally put bullshit into my shows. And once I've realized that, I've always tried to pull it out and mitigate it and diminish that aspect of it. Because I just don't want to be putting more bullshit into a world that is already saturated with it.
Yeah, putting as much truth into the show in a show of, you know, deception is, I mean, it's something that's talked about a lot, but I don't think a lot of audiences really comprehend it. Yeah. So if you can keep it, you know, honest and legit as much as possible, yeah. it makes a big difference.
Even if only a minority of your audience will know or care. Yeah. Against those minorities, because those the like, because magic is a big part of my life. It's not just my career; it's my primary passion and creative output. I've met some of my best friends, and you know, I've ended up in relationships through magic and doing shows and that. I don't want that part of my life to be based on lies and insincerity.
Sure, it's the most honest art form you can do in certain ways, because not always, and in many cases no.
Well, like, you know, all those routines based around showing, look, I have amazing card shark skills, where you're actually doing where you're faking middle deals and stuff like that. There's a lot of, you know, it can still be a profound tool for deception and BS, but it can be very honest. It absolutely has that potential, and that's always what I strive for, even if I don't always manage to achieve that.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking about this, something else I wanted to talk about today. We were talking at Panera Bread, North Hollywood Panera Bread, the slowest Panera Bread in all of America. We were talking about social media, and I've noticed in the past couple weeks of just like spending a little bit more time promoting or posting stuff on social media than I would, simply because I'm sitting on a cruise ship doing nothing, twiddling my thumbs. And I'm like, oh, that's funny. I'll post that, or I'll take a video of that and put it up on my Instagram story. And I've noticed in a weird way, the show has kind of suffered. I don't know if it's super noticeable, but it felt like, you know, I pulled focus to social media stuff, and then the show wasn't my primary focus. Therefore, I didn't feel like I had as strong of shows. And it could be just hypothetical, but I don't know. We were just kind of talking about, we don't know a lot of people that put 100% of their focus into social media and also are good live performers.
Yeah. Well, even if it's not 100% focus, I was sort of saying, of all my favorite performers in any genre, almost none of them have good social media presence.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if my hypothesis is an inverse, like, correlation or causative relationship there, that the kind of person who would do the kind of performing that I love to watch is not the kind of person who would get into the spinny, surfacey, pretentious bullshit that is most social media promo.
Who needs to put out a 30-second video every day, or else they're afraid they'll lose
followers. All that jazz. Because, I mean, social media is fundamentally fake. It's fundamentally, like, not fundamentally, that's me exaggerating, but most of it is very intrinsically, it's about the surface, it's about perception, it's about image crafting, you're never getting the whole story.
Yeah.
Or at least very rarely. And even when you get the whole story, you still never get the whole story. Because I make sure that everything I post is real and sincere, and I don't want to image craft because I don't want to make the world a worse place. I think you're, like, leading by example. You know, be the change you want in the world. I want
people
to be...
Ooh, that's deep. Did you write that?
Yeah, right. That's yeah, all job. Original. Yeah. Ooh. The... what's my train of thought? Yeah, and so I try to do that. But even with that, even when I'm telling the truth, I realize even because I can't tell the whole story, it still ends up being misleading. And it bothers me when friends and family and people I know or care about, or, you know, even strangers, like, end up thinking that my life is very different from what it is just because social media can never really accurately represent anything.
I was so – and it was a little bit risky to post, but I posted a photo of me sitting alone – I think I was on the Grand Cayman Islands.
No, I remember this. It was some kind of the irony of life.
I was sitting in a Margaritaville because that was the only thing that was open at noon, having my second margarita and slightly tipsy. And I took a photo of myself and it just said black and white. And all it says is the glamorous life of the, you know, traveling performer. Because I'm so, it drives me nuts. I post photos. I'm like, hey, look at this. I'm traveling. This is fun. But also, I want people to know the reality of it.
Yeah, know that it is glorious and also horrible. Like, it is both. It definitely is wonderful. We're unbelievably privileged. This should be like two privileged dudes complaining about their lives, the podcast.
And it's not complaining about that at all. Yeah. It's just, I want people to know, because I think people just, it drives me nuts when people, and it's always, you know, meant out of love and kindness, but when people comment on something and go, oh, I'm so glad you're following your dreams.
Living the dream. It's like, no, screw you. This is absolutely not the dream. This is great, and this is en route to the dream.
Yeah.
But this is, there is this shitty, like, annoying, frustrating boring, lonely, inane side to it that is part of the reality. That's what makes the glorious moments worthwhile.
I did three shows last week, and I was on a ship for 8 of those days. Mm. You know, and three shows in 8 days is, you know, you go nuts. And I worked with another guest entertainer, a musician, and she posted a video of, and this is called, she playing a song, and then it was a video as the music going on of her traveling the world, you know, like the plane going, and then you see her going to a nice hotel, and I'm sitting with one of the other guest entertainers, and we're like, only if it was that glamorous, you know? But
And also because for people who are, you know, struggling with their lives, who are depressed, or, you know, I mean, we were talking about Daryl way back. I still think about that a lot. People who are suicidal. Like, there are few things darker than opening up whatever and feeling like everyone else's life is amazing and yours is the shit one. Like, share the truth, people. Share the dark sides as well as the light sides. And the problem is, even through saying that, like, I know the sad truth is that will probably make you have a net negative effect on your career. Because that whole thing of, you know, blah, blah, fake it till you make it, success breeds success. If people think that everything, you're kicking ass at everything, they're more likely to hire you, blah, blah, blah. Because selling the dream and the fantasy and the fake thing, like, that's all true and it works. So I don't really know what the answer to any of it is.
On your website, if you have a corporate website and you're selling, hey, I've done this, this, and this, that's fine. You don't necessarily want to also have a blog post about, hey, I'm really sad today. Mm. But I think from a social media perspective of where you're constantly interacting with people, post something, hey, this is something great I'm doing. Hey, this is something I'm struggling with.
Yeah. But the problem is social media is now the new website. That's now, for many people, the primary source of research and connection. So it's in people's interest to image craft their lives and careers.
So I would never, I take that back because I guess I posted that photo on my personal Instagram and Facebook and fan page. But I don't know.
And it probably, you know, it's not inconceivable that might have cost you a booking somewhere.
Sure.
Right? From someone going, oh, no, Nick's life sucks.
Oh, he's not as good as we thought.
Yeah, he must not be that. It's that whole thing. There was a study somewhere psychologically that found that, if people, I think this was an actual study, but if people applaud, they feel the show was better. Even if you had to milk for the applause.
Yeah.
It's just that psychological, I can't remember the name of the, there's a cognitive bias that explains it psychologically, but the whole, I think it's part, kind of the halo effect, sort of, but about situations rather than people. But yeah, if everyone's applauding, your brain subconsciously, without you knowing, is going, oh, people applaud good shows, we're applauding, therefore this is a good show, like reverse causality bias or something.
Yeah.
And same thing, wow, if this person's life, it looks like this amazing, insane dream, they must also be really good. Blah, 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 and all that other stuff. So, I don't know. Being sincere might actually be bad advice.
What do we know? We're just two cruise ship magicians living the dream.
More than ship guys.
That's true.
It's still good to be a ship guy.
I can't do, I only do a handful of ships because I can't be away from that long. I was talking with the other guest entertainers, and they're like, are you coming back next week? Because they were going on to other ships immediately. And I was like, oh, no, I'm going back. I got a couple of gigs. And they were just amazed that I had land work.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how they phrased it.
Hilarious, isn't it? Yeah, working land. Oh, it's amazing.
And I never saw it as anything amazing. But now I'm thankful for it because, cruise ships pay my rent, but I don't want to be on it 24/7.
There's a comedian in Melbourne called Laura Davis who does really great stuff. I've seen very little of her stuff. And she did a show, a few years ago in the Melbourne Comedy Festival called Pillow of Strength. And I never saw it. I had shows at the same time. There was literally no night I could get to see it. But I really wanted to, and maybe I will get to, maybe she'll do it again. But there was a line in the blurb, and the line was something, something, something. It was a show about the struggle to stay soft in a hard world. And that really resonated with me. And I'd love to see the show. I suspect it would be really, really powerful. But I think about that day. Like, for me, the struggle to stay sincere in a world that celebrates bullshit.
Sure.
It's a struggle, and it's something you've really got to consciously manage because often it's not in your interest to be sincere.
I mean, we're fighting it. I mean, this has been talked about a million times in the past year, but we're fighting it now politically of regardless of where you stand, you know, the opposition is lying.
Yeah.
I personally believe that, you know, were the people I listen to and trust are telling the truth, yeah. and I think the other side's wrong, but I'm not going to open up that can of worms. But we are – that's just a whole new spiral of where we're at today.
We often seem to get existential, Nick.
We always – you know what? I just want to start – we need to just start recording for about 20 minutes, and I think our conversation actually is helpful for people about 20 minutes in. Yeah. So if you do listen to future episodes, just skip the first 20 minutes.
It gets deep after about 20 minutes.
It gets deep, but I hope it helps people because this is crap I think about on a second-to-second basis.
Likewise.
And I feel alone most of the time because I'll bring it up in conversation and people just stare at you.
Yeah, that look of, huh, what? Because they're just existing on the surface bullshit level.
Yeah.
I think where most people – I don't know. It's tough to know. Depending on how you look at it, that you can argue most people are actually fundamentally good, decent people who are just confused and trying to do what they think is best.
Sure.
Or you can, I don't know.
Tough stuff.
Two magicians, one mic, guys.
Oh, yeah. So we talked about the social media. We talked about the creating. Ships, we kind of touched on. I want to talk about that. Oh, I saw a show yesterday. It's a two-person show Kate Flannery from The Office does.
Oh, yeah. Kate's great.
I met her briefly at Brookledge a couple weeks ago.
Was it the lamp? Was she lampshading?
The lampshade show. They do like this old lounge act that's been on Ships for their whole life, and it's just brilliant.
It's a deliberate parody of a terrible washed-up lounge act,
and it was a joy to watch.
Very
and
funny.
One of our friends, Carl Herlinger, who's an amazing ventriloquist, was on. He did a brilliant.
Oh, is he the one who does the meta ventriloquist?
He did. Like, he calls it existentialism.
I love
triloquism.
Him and
I always
his
get
stuff
it wrong
so much.
If you don't know
I
Carl,
bet his social media sucks.
He's okay. He's okay. He's the reason I found out about that show and the other. He's not bad. He doesn't have a huge following, but he should.
See, that's exactly. I by the way, tangent on that. I did a gig Indianapolis Fringe Festival. It was great. Loved it. Met great people. Did great shows. A girl came up to me. Because I like to be in the audience as the people come in. I like to say hi's, but I like to mingle and get to know them a little bit before the show. And was chatting to this girl, like, oh, hey, thanks for coming. How did you guys hear about the show? She was like, oh, something on – she saw it on the website. She said, I looked at your Instagram and Facebook. You travel a lot, right? You do shows all over the world. Yeah, that is true. She's like, so why don't you have more followers? Because I have hundreds of followers, I think, maybe 800. And that right there, that question was very telling. This idea that quality and or experience relates to follow account. That's what most people believe to be true, even though it couldn't be further from the truth a lot of the time.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I've caught myself doing that in a weird way, too. I'll go on somebody who either follows me or somebody who pops up. I'm like, oh, they don't have a lot of followers, but they're doing a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
so that's cool.
But, again, good rather than famous.
Yeah, and then you go on these Instagram accounts that have 24,000 followers and they're all just photos of themselves.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who follows these people?
Look, remember that Who magazine and the National Enquirer sell lots of copies.
It's
or at least
true.
Used to back in the day before print media
died.
No,
I think they still do in some ways.
Yeah, just people want simple, basic stuff. You know, girls and guys want to look at photos of hot girls.
Sure.
That's why that'll always win over everything. But you were saying the lampshades, Carl.
Yeah,
Hollinger.
So Carl does an amazing, just brilliant bit where he, I'm not going to ruin any of it, but...
he's a ventriloquist who's brilliant, just surprising and goes to places that you don't expect that then end up being very clever.
And my dad's a ventriloquist and I grew up going to ventriloquist conventions and, you just see a lot of bad stuff and a lot of people that are just... hobbyists and aren't self-aware enough.
The same schlocky stuff.
And you have – it's almost like I think good variety has to be self-aware in some way. Just I know what I'm doing is ridiculous, but come along for the journey because I think you'll really enjoy it.
Would you say that ventriloquism – I know a little bit about ventriloquism. Would you say it's even more prone to hackiness than magic?
Sure, because there are essentially –
there's fewer things you can do, aren't there?
There's essentially five bits.
Yeah, right.
Making somebody else talk, making a wooden figure talk, making your hand talk, making a distant voice talk, and doing a bad Japanese movie. That's essentially, those are the big, four or five.
Yeah, right.
And when they're done well, they're brilliant.
And if it's you and a wooden figure, you're kind of constrained to sort of straight person, funny person, two person.
Yeah, it's always
sort of
straight man, comedy man. There's always it's always a back and forth, and But yeah, what Carl's doing is just, you know, brilliant. So I encourage you to look him up.
And I think it's a reminder that there are always other things you can do, just most people don't. Most people take the easy way out and just do the same thing. Well, they see something that works and then emulate.
Going back to creating stuff, you know, three of the things I'm interested in working on right now, I'm watching YouTube videos, and it's almost dangerous to do because I'm trying to get inspiration, but at the same time, I think subconsciously I'm going to pull a Robin Williams and just steal something without even realizing it.
It just gets into your subconscious and you genuinely, can not know where it came from.
But it's tough because you can see where the boundaries are and you see how people break the limits on certain ideas in terms of trying to work on some card manipulation.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It can be absurdly boring, but there's stuff people are doing with it that can make it interesting for the audience, but I don't want to steal those things. So I'm at the point where I just want to quit, even though I just bought like two expensive packs of, you know, manipulation decks.
Yeah. Well, that's effort to reward ratio. Which card manipulation, I think, is quite the ratio might be in a tough direction. It's a lot of effort for a good amount of reward, but are there things that could be less effort for greater reward that their time might better be spent on?
It's legitimately hard to do well, and I don't think the audience necessarily cares that much. Mm. But anyway, the other person I want to talk about was Billy the Mime. He was doing his stuff. He's brilliant, and he did a bit called A Meeting with Harvey Weinstein.
Oh, wow.
And I talked to him after, and he said it was only like the third or fourth time he's done it, but it was it's what art is, because it starts off funny, and then it keeps going, and you're like, oh, wow, this
is... So, for context, I've only ever seen him perform once, and it was his... What was the name of that serial killer?
Oh, I think he does. I can't remember which one he do.
It's like, it wasn't Ted Bundy. It was someone else.
He might do Ted Bundy or he might do John Wayne Gacy. I don't remember which one.
But anyway, so for those who don't know, Billy the Mime comes out.
If you've seen the movie The Aristocrats, he's in it in several spots. I found out.
He comes out very much evocative of the traditional Marcel Marceau white-faced mime. Like, because now, remember, modern mime is so much more than that. It goes in so many different directions. But to a lot of people, that's the cliche of the, oh, God, mime.
That's the reason I don't take most mime gigs that come out with it. We're having a French theme.
Yeah, exactly.
Billy the Mime comes out
deliberately leaning into that stereotype. White face, very exaggerated movements, holds up a title card. Again, much like Marcel Marceau, and who I saw once and was underwhelmed. I was like, okay, this was probably great in the 70s. Before people had seen, you know, before art had moved on. And that's what happens. It improves. So Billy comes out and you're expecting, okay, a hokey, mimey thing. And then always, I think, goes into something dark and subversive and fucked up and strange and powerful and just really plays with subverting expectation about the concept of a mime and then genuinely does something brilliant in its own right beyond that.
Yeah.
It's just the double whammy.
Yeah, from a physicality, you know, trained mind perspective, it's amazing.
I'd love to see if he's doing a Weinstein bit.
He's
someone I trust. It'll be amazing.
It was amazing, and it's heartbreaking at the same time.
Yeah,
because I've seen him do his other one called Drinks with Bill Cosby, and
oh wow,
it starts off very funny and gets dark.
Yeah,
really, it stops being funny.
That's amazing.
But he keeps going and just really kind of puts you through it, and it's what. And I'm just sitting there watching this going, man, I don't know. It goes back to the social media thing. I think a fair amount of people know who he is. And it also comes back to just doing solid, amazing work. Him, Carl, Lampshades, all those people. And I don't know. I just kind of – you really feel it. You see – I think in our case, we see so many shows being here in L.A., especially being a cast member. You got to get your money's worth, so you go and see multiple shows a week if you can. Yeah. And very few times do you walk out of a show really carrying it with you.
Yeah, really profoundly affected in whatever way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really having being impacted by it.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's something I'll ever achieve, but it's certainly a goal to strive for.
And that's the thing. Again, there are so many ways to climb that mountain. If the mountaintop is really deeply affecting an audience, it can just be so funny. That it really got to you. It can be so revealing that it got to you. It can be so dark it got to you. It can be just so rawly impressive that it got to you. There are many paths up that, but really caring and trying to find ways to climb that mountain
rather than just trying to get your Instagram follower count up, which I think is a lot of performers.
Yeah.
People and human beings. This is so far beyond.
I felt so dirty. I went through a couple days ago and just like invited a whole bunch of people that I was Facebook friends with to my, you know, Nick Paul fan page, Magical Cat. And I just like, every click, I was like, I'm sorry.
I'm so sorry.
And the whole point is because I'm doing some TV submission stuff right now. And it's like, I know if I don't have higher friggin' followers, they're just going to pass me by. And I hate the whole thing. I'm sorry to everybody. And thank you to like the people that did accept it. And the people that didn't, no judgments. Because I've ignored it many times from people. I get it. But it is what it is. It's tough. Do we want to wrap up this with a summary of the quest for Simon Cornell's money?
Oh, my God.
It's a long story.
Oh, it's a long story.
But a brilliant one. a brilliant one in how not to make mistakes.
Learn from do as I say, not as I do, guys. Don't do what I did.
Because you're gonna come up with a whole blog post.
Yeah, I've nearly finished this. I'm a very slow writer because I read this. There was this amazing quote by Charlie Kaufman at the BAFTA Awards where he had this line. He said, "I think that writers are people for whom writing is harder than other people," and that really resonated. I'm a slow writer because I really care about making it really great, and sometimes it's great. A lot of the stuff I've written, I look at it and go, eh. That's adequate.
Yeah.
Every now and then I write something where I go, oh, that's really good. I'd enjoy reading that if someone else had written it. And I've been writing the story of my Macau money for a couple of months now, on and off, here and there, and it's nearly done. And essentially, the very brief summary is we did the House of Magic gig. We got paid. They made us Bank of China. Bank accounts that are ours. They paid us into those accounts. All good. And, you know, it's China, so you suspect it might be dodgy. So we asked around. We checked other people who'd done the gig. They all said, nope, it's fine. It's great. Check's cleared. Fantastic. So I thought, oh, that's fine, which was my first mistake. Complacency. Step mistake number one. And then you did the smart thing. You took your money out in units as you went.
And transferred it to your American account.
Yeah, well, that. I was lucky that I wasn't like hand-to-mouthing it at the time, so I just figured I'll leave it all in, do it in one shot, save on transfer fees. You know, save the extra,
$30? $5?
It's like $20, I think.
Oh, you're true. Transfer. Yeah, because depending on your bank, there's like an incoming fee.
Exactly, and all that jazz. So I thought, you know, I'll do it. And then obviously do a little test transfer just to check, because international routing numbers can get really complicated. And I was obviously intending to do that before I left Macau, but I got busy packing. It was all crazy.
What day did you try this out? What day was it again? It was the day you were leaving for America.
Look, I had a lot of plans.
Oh, Nick. And it was a holiday.
that's what it was. It was the day I was going to do it. It was a bank holiday in Macau. It turns out Macau has a lot of bank holidays, as I then would go on to discover.
We had a lot of holidays there.
Yeah, and there was. And I just got really busy. I didn't give myself enough time. That was my worst mistake. So I got back to America and thought, and also we were being paid monthly at that point. So our last payment was going to come in after we'd left. So I thought, I might as well wait for the final payment to clear and then do it. I'd already checked I could log into net banking. It's fine. You can transfer at any time. No big deal. Got back to the land of democracy and sat down in sunny California to log into net banking and do my transfer, and I couldn't log into net banking. And look, that's fine. Maybe I hadn't logged in for a few months since I first tested that it worked. Maybe I had forgotten the password, or I was pretty sure I remembered it, but it was a weird interface because it's China and they program everything weirdly. That's fine. I'll just do a password reset. There's always a way to do that. You just forgot your password, sends you an email, blah. Maybe you have to call up and verify code. It's a bank. Cool. I call up. Go through the nightmare of trying to communicate with the person. Again, I'm leaving out a lot of steps because we've only got a few minutes. The whole version will be soon on thingsbysimon.com. I'll probably even tweet about it. I'll make an Instagram post.
Maybe you'll get a follower.
Try and maintain my sufficient level of insincerity to make it in life. Got through to tech support. They said, to reset your password, just come into the branch with your passport to prove your identity. I explained that I was 8,000 miles away and that wouldn't happen. He said, just come in next when you're back in Macau. I was hopefully never going to do that, ever, ideally. Well, not never. Never say never. I'd go again. Like I said, I'd do the gig again if it was a month rather than three.
Sure.
I explained that wouldn't be happening. He got confused, sounded confused, went to said, "Hang on, can I put you on hold?" Clearly went to go and find out how to deal with this incomprehensible situation. And apparently the process is, he said, "Okay, so we're going to email you a form. You have to print it out, sign it, scan it, email it back, and then we will mail you a new temporary password in the mail from Macau to LA." And this worried me. And so I went, all right, fine. It's going to take a couple of weeks probably to get over here. Who knows? Macau's postal system was a bit janky, as we both learned.
No Amazon Prime.
Nothing. Trying to get anything sent. Very difficult. And fill out the form, send it back, and they replied with an email saying, "Hey, yeah, your signature doesn't match the one in the file."
This happened to us, but this happened to us in person.
Yeah, exactly. Turns out, now, you know when you sign your signature, Nick, and dear listeners who are mostly Westerners, I'm sure, it's never exactly the same. It varies a bit.
No, growing up, you're just like, 90% of the time when I have to sign my signature, I just make a smiley face on the digital thing, and it works.
Yeah, it will actually work. You know, signature varies a lot. It's about the same, whatever. We don't really care about exact signature detail. As I discovered in China, they really care.
It, like,
has to exactly match.
I made my S wrong. Like, it was
a little bit too slopey. Different. Yeah. Signature doesn't match. Well, shit. All right. And I realized at that point, maybe I was probably paying a bit more attention. So I signed it a bit more formally, like a bit more, you know, less squigglishly. Sent it back. No, it still doesn't match. And this went back and forth as I suddenly realized, holy shit, like if they're not going to accept the signature. I thought about making ATM withdrawals. I went to a Bank of China in LA, but it turns out Bank of China that has a branch in LA, totally different system to Bank of China Macau, a wholly owned subsidiary.
And Bank of China Hong Kong, I discovered just 100 miles down
the
road.
Same parent company.
And it's a good thing I had cash in my pocket or else we wouldn't have been getting home.
Yep. And this Kafka-esque nightmare continued to unfold as I tried more ways to get my money, all of which hit roadblocks. And I was creative and I was scrappy and everything. And it just continued and continued and everything until...
So we got out of there in April. This is November.
It's now November. I still 3 months of wages.
And we
are
won't
still
say
locked.
How much money, but
it's
a lot of money.
It's enough money that you really care about.
It's enough money that you go to China for 3 months
to
perform.
Yeah, exactly. It's the entire 3 months of money. From that gig is
you
still
touched
in
none
it.
Of it.
I've touched none of it. I withdrew a bit while we were there to live on, you know, to buy cheese and things like that. I don't know. That money has been inaccessible, locked away this entire year. Again, so many more chapters in this ongoing saga of me trying to find a way to actually get my money, including I went to China.
Forgot about this part.
Well, because I realized at any given point, if I just rocked up to the branch with my passport, that was, you know, that would be able to fix it. I'd be able to stand there and not leave. Like, here's me, here's my passport. I'll sign the things. You know, I call up Aaron, our contact at House of Magic, who's a great guy. And I called him at one point, and he said, "Oh man, yeah, that's rough.
That sucks."
He said, "You know, they're happy to like, but there's nothing they can do about the banking regulations. Like at that point, it's between me and the bank. You know, I have the money legally in my possession in my legally owned bank account." You know, it's a good thing the casino at that point can't do anything.
You were gone. He had no legal obligation to help you.
Well, and Aaron was happy to help, but there was pretty much nothing he could do.
And what day did you show up to that bank? What kind of day was it in China?
It was bank holiday.
It was another bank holiday is what it was.
Bank holiday. Because
it was Tuesday.
So got a gig in Beijing, long story short. That's its own insane story. I think we talked about that
last
week.
We did talk about that last month.
Yeah. Went to Beijing, and I thought, oh my God, it'll be like a movie where
it's
you're going over. But one person in the team has a secret agenda that's their real reason for going, and that's to get to Macau. We had one day off that I could get to Macau in. There was this one day window because we couldn't extend the trip. I had to be back for a gig in LA that was very important. And I think in this one day, I'm going to fly to Macau, do the proof of ID thing, maybe even just withdraw my money in cash and carry it back at that point. I just wanted to not take any risks. Looked into the flights. If I took the earliest morning flight and the latest evening flight, it would give me exactly 3 hours in Macau.
Flying direct into Macau.
Yeah, Beijing to Macau, go from the airport to the bank, bank to airport, back out. It would be a 3-hour window.
Wow.
Because there wasn't a lot of flexibility. And Beijing to Macau is still a 5-hour flight.
Yep.
So people don't know, China's a big place. Mm-hmm. And Beijing's up at the north, Macau's right down the south near Hong Kong and all that jazz. And 3 hours. And that was theoretically maybe enough. And if this were a screenplay, I would definitely have done it. Because that'd make a great drama.
You get the money.
Get the money, make it there just in time.
And then you get the girl in the end.
Exactly.
It's that one girl that you dated that one time and you thought you'd never see again. Exactly. But she's like, hey, I'm going to America too.
One of my friends who works in film and TV has already said this would make an amazing screenplay.
You need to write this.
The money's in Macau. Like, it's got all the ingredients of great, insane drama.
That idea. Copyright.
Well,
Simon Cornell.
It's nearly written. It's about 2,000 words and counting, just the story, as brief as I can tell it. Just to get the, and I made the call, and at that point, the price, because Beijing to Macau is still a five-hour flight, it was nearly as much as a round trip from L.A. because it was short notice. And I just went, you know what, 3 hours, that could go wrong. I could do all this and it'd be for nothing.
Sure.
This is not the right time. Like, so close. I could taste it. And then finally just bombarded them with signatures. I ended up sending in that form. I signed a piece of paper about 30 times, used for it, and just the second they replied saying the signature didn't match, sent another one, and finally wore them down. Then there was another insane chapter because then they – oh, God. In summary, I've spent 7 months trying to get my money out of Macau, and literally yesterday – I finally managed to log into
Yeah, my phone is blowing up. I'm in a show. And you're like a one-texter guy. You're
I'm a laconic texter.
Done. And then I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Is he okay? And then all I see is, it's happening, Nick. It's really happening. I'm like, losing your virginity? What's happening? I don't know.
Nah, that's still coming. Looking forward to that. It's going to be great. I've heard. Yeah, because you of all people, there are a few close friends who have been on along for this whole saga, but you've been there more than anybody.
And I was honored to be a part of it, but I go to Kristen, I'm like, why is it every time I go see a show, people suddenly start texting me? I get no text throughout the day, no text.
Particularly this guy who never texts anyone. but basically I finally got the temporary password to work. I finally managed to get the temporary password. Then I got it. Then it didn't work. Then there was this other thing. Finally, and I logged in. And I went, oh my God. Because you had helpfully way back shown me, you know, how to actually do the transfers and what codes to put in and all that
jazz.
Once
again, being cheap has its rewards.
Yeah.
You figure out how to send money from China to America.
And so I finally put in my test little $10 transfer to check that I've got all the routing numbers right. And it said accepted. Still have my RSA secure ID token. Thank God, because I nearly lost it. That would have added another.
Well, just to add a little sidetrack, this is a little token they give you. So once you log in, add in all the details to submit the transfer, you have to add in a second password again. And then there's this little robot machine that they gave you that has a sequence of numbers that changes every time you log in. And if you don't input that exact sequence of numbers, you're not getting your money.
Which is, it's good. It's a great, it's known as the two-factor authentication, RSA,
it's smart,
token generators.
But
they're
could
great.
Easily just like text you that number or email
true.
It to you.
Well, yeah, more and more places are using SMS verification. And thank God I still... And so it said transfer accepted. So within a few business days to allow for the transfer, if I see that $10 in my U.S. account, it's happening.
Now, I got to be honest, I'm a little bit nervous you only did 10 bucks because they do take some money
out
there.
I clicked the option that said fee
good.
Additionally to that.
Okay.
So, yeah, I spent hours quadruple-checking... Every element of the form. Oh, which reminds me, this was amazing as well. So I get into the banking form. So I'm just, again, the fact that I was logged into Macau Net Banking was amazing. And in the international transfer form, it's such a Chinese website.
Sure.
So I go in, it's got all the things. There's an option, I'm reading from this screenshot I took. What country is the bank in that you're transferring to? United States. Then you can choose city. What city is the bank in? Right, you know, it's Los Angeles, obviously. These are the options it gives you under city. After you've selected country, USA, city, and I quote, Atlanta, GA, Minneapolis, MN, New York / Chinese characters, Pasadena, Pittsburgh, PA, San Francisco, and other. But that's the list. I love that just Pasadena is in there. Like the complete inconsistency in, like, it's one of the most half-assed things I've ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And so I obviously clicked other and then just typed in the address of the bank.
And we'll find out. So this is
still breaking news. This story is unfolding literally as we speak. I'm waiting to see if the transfer comes through, and then if that lasts, then I can actually make the big transfer of of 3 months of wages.
Let's hope. Fingers crossed. Chopsticks crossed.
Oh God.
Well, that's a good way to end. And man, that short story took about 15 minutes.
Look, that was the short version.
Yeah.
The long version.
I look forward to the blog post. It's coming. So should everybody. yeah, thanks for listening. Have a happy holiday season. We'll be out in the new year with a new episode. And that's about it. My name is Nick Paul.
My name is Simon Coronel, who might be about... I can't believe I've nearly finally got my money. 7 months of this.
I just see it on your face.
It's 7 months of this, back and forth with Bank of China Macau.
It's a good thing. Months. It's a good thing. Everything's going to be good.
I was going to invest in Ethereum before it blew up.
Oh, man.
I was actually thinking about that.
Yeah.
Didn't have the money.
Mm-hmm.
Was stuck in Macau.
Well, I invested in Tesla and I made some money, so nice. Don't feel bad about that.
So happy for you, Nick.
And then it started dropping rapidly. I'm like, sell! Sell! Oh, no. Again. I blew my feedback prediction. But anyway, anybody, thanks so much for listening.
I'm at Simon Coroner. I'm at Things by Simon on every whatever app you have. See, look at me social media whoring.
I didn't even bring it up, and you bring it up.
At Things by Simon on literally everything.
At Nick Paul Magic, because you need to see photos of me sitting alone in Margaritaville.
I uploaded a photo of my stack of cardstock today, actually.
You should.
If you go to Instagram, you'll be able to see my stack of cardstock.
You can like it.
You can.
And people can see it.
And then I'll feel validated as a human being, and TV shows will be more likely to cast me.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But not really. anyway, have a happy holidays and a new year. We'll see you soon.
Peace out.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to Two Magicians, One Mic podcasts. Please rate us on iTunes. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Visit our website, www.twomagiciansonemic.com. Send fan mail or hate mail to twomagiciansonemic@gmail.com. Have a great week.